Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Belgium has long struggled to deal with its colonial past. The small European country controlled large parts of Central Africa from the early 1900s to the 1960s. During colonial rule, millions of Africans died from disease, starvation, and violence. Recently, Belgium's Royal Museum for Central Africa reopened after 5 years of building repairs and improvements. The $73 million effort aims to show visitors the reality of colonial rule and modern Africa. The Royal Museum for Central Africa first opened in 1910 during the rule of King Leopold II. The museum was set up to show the power of his empire and the colonial riches it provided. Just more than 100 years later, museum workers have tried to completely change that. Guido Grassils is the current director.
Our aim was to make a museum of contemporary Africa on the Africa of today, but at the same time to also bring a very critical look on the colonial past of Belgium. We recognize now the many victims of colonization, the African victims of colonization. We recognize too that there were a lot of the racist attitudes that were developed at that time have their consequences today.
Those ideas are personified by a group of statues showing Africans as simple and animal-like. The statues formerly were placed all around the building. They are now kept in an underground room. The museum also had a collection of living things from the colonies. This zoo served as home to more than 250 Congolese people. They were forced to wear traditional clothing. 7 died from being out in cold weather. Museum workers have been doing research on other collections. This new information has been added to some objects. It tells where they came from and explains their importance. Videos provide an African understanding of issues such as culture, colonialism, and the environment. King Leopold II built the museum to raise money for mining and rubber production in what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. It is estimated that up to 15 million Congolese died from disease, starvation, and mass killings under colonial rule. Marielle Toussy-Robert is with Bamko Cran, a Brussels-based anti-racism group. She says the museum has not gone far enough to show the horrible nature of colonialism. Robert says that when the museum is presented as a museum of Africa and not one of colonization, it creates misunderstandings. She added, "We need to make a real museum of colonization. We need to deal with our colonial history. It is really something that is missing in Belgium." Director Grissil says he is open to returning stolen goods to Africa.
Well, certainly it's not normal that 80% of African art is in European museums or in European private collections. So we have to make sure that they can get much greater access to our collections.
Record cold weather in the United States is forcing schools and businesses to close. The polar vortex, as it is called, has also canceled flights and suspended mail delivery. The temperature in Fargo, North Dakota, dropped to minus 35 degrees Celsius. In Chicago, Illinois, it was minus 28 degrees Celsius, but strong winds made the air feel like minus 50 degrees. The U.S. National Weather Service warns that a wind chill of minus 32 degrees Celsius could freeze a person's skin within 15 minutes. Officials turned city buses into mobile warming shelters to help keep homeless people safe. It all started with misplaced heat from Morocco, says winter storm expert Judah Cohen. He works for atmospheric and environmental research in Massachusetts. Last month, Cohen explains, the usually cold air some 30 kilometers above the North Pole quickly warmed by about 70 degrees Celsius. The area of air is known as a polar vortex. There is also a polar vortex above the South Pole. The quick temperature change was the result of hot air flowing in from the south. The warmer air split the polar vortex, leaving smaller pieces of it to move around. By Tuesday night, one of those vortex pieces reached the middle of the United States. The unusually cold air could stay around for several weeks. I think at a minimum, we are looking at mid-February, possibly through mid-March, Cohen said. Americans first began hearing the words polar vortex 5 years ago. In early 2014, the temperatures dropped to minus 27 degrees Celsius in places like Chicago. Weather experts, who had been using the term for many years, began using it on social media. But the National Weather Service says there is nothing new about it. It says the years 1977, 1982, 1985, and 1989 also brought unusually cold temperatures caused by a polar vortex. As Americans dealt with the extreme cold, President Donald Trump called for the return of global warming. He wrote on Twitter, "In the beautiful Midwest, wind chill temperatures are reaching minus 60 degrees, the coldest ever recorded. In coming days, expected to get even colder. People can't last outside even for minutes. What the hell is going on with global warming? Please come back fast. We need you." John Cook is a professor of climate change at George Mason University in Virginia. He said Trump's comment about the cold weather ignores the larger picture of a warming planet. He compared the president's comment to someone saying that nighttime proves the sun doesn't exist. Climate scientist Victor Gensini said, "This is simply an extreme weather event and not representative of global-scale temperature trends." Gensini, who works at Northern Illinois University, told the Associated Press, "The exact opposite is happening in Australia right now." Last week, the city of Adelaide, Australia, reached 46.6 degrees Celsius, the highest temperature ever recorded in a major Australian city. But it was even hotter in nearby Port Augusta, where temperatures reached 49.5 degrees Celsius. Another climate scientist, Zeke Housefather of Berkeley Earth, said it was important to remember the difference between climate and weather. In a warming world, you are still going to have unusually hot and unusually cold events happening in a particular part of the world, House Father said. Weather is not going away.
When we think about people with cancer, the images that usually come to our minds may be dark and sad. But that is not what Linda McCarthy sees. McCarthy is a photographer. For her Survivors Project, she took pictures of women who survived or are being treated for breast cancer. She says her goal was to put a face on breast cancer.
I wanted to photograph them as whole women, not the parts that they see of themselves. And I didn't want scars and I didn't want anything like that, but I wanted them to see how beautiful they are.
One of the survivors is Cheryl Listman. In 2013, tests showed that she had stage 2B breast cancer. Listman was told she had a 40% chance of survival. Thinking about her two children helped her decide not to give up and to keep fighting the disease. Listman said she liked the idea of the Survivors Photography Project. I work with women. I help educate women who are going through the journey and just help them navigate through the medical side of it, she said. When McCarthy asked to take her picture for the project, Listman thought it might be yet another way to influence other women. It also helped her to look back in time and see how far she had come over the past few years. The idea of publicizing breast cancer survivors came to McCarthy when she was searching for a ballerina to photograph. During her search, she met a woman named Maggie, who was known as the Bald Ballerina. Doctors told Maggie when she was 23 that she had stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. McCarthy asked if she could take her picture, not as a dancer, but as a beautiful girl who happens to have breast cancer. McCarthy told VOA she has always sought to capture the heart and spirit of her subjects. To do that, McCarthy offered each woman she photographed a chance to meet and talk openly. This gave McCarthy a chance to get to know them. The women were also offered a makeover. They worked with makeup artist Victoria Ronan.
In some cases, it's been a very long time since they've had makeup on. It's been a very long time since they've done something for themselves. I've had a lot of women look in the mirror and just start tearing up because they can't believe how beautiful I've made them look.
Listman says it is helpful for breast cancer fighters and survivors to feel beautiful.
It's very important. Because when you go through a horrific journey and treatment, you don't feel beautiful. And there's a lot of things done to your body physically. There's a lot of things done to you emotionally, mentally, things that you'll never forget that are not pretty. So when you get to that point in your journey, you feel like a woman again. You feel beautiful. You feel like, you know, you've accomplished the mission.
McCarthy says she hopes that one day she will write a book about her experience capturing survivors in photographs. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By February 1, 1861, 7 southern states had withdrawn from the United States of America. They created their own independent nation, the Confederate States of America. The South seceded because Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, had been elected president. Southerners believed he would support a constitutional ban on slavery. They were afraid their way of life would soon end. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe discuss the beginning of Abraham Lincoln's presidency.
President-elect Lincoln traveled by train from his home in Illinois to Washington, D.C. Along the way, he stopped to make speeches. As he got closer to Washington, he was warned that a mob was planning to attack the train. He had to continue his trip in secret. Lincoln arrived in Washington 9 days before his inauguration. It was a busy time. He talked with many people, including delegates to a peace convention. Every state was represented at the convention, except the states that had seceded. The delegates urged Lincoln to support slavery. They urged him not to go to war over the issue. Lincoln said only that he would faithfully execute the duties of president of all the United States. He said he would protect and defend the American Constitution.
While Lincoln waited for Inauguration Day, he chose the members of his cabinet. He wanted men representing all opposing groups in the Republican Party. He hoped this would unite the party and give him support in the difficult years ahead. Lincoln chose William Seward as Secretary of State, Salmon Chase as Treasury Secretary, Gideon Welles as Navy Secretary, and Montgomery Blair as Postmaster General. Seward did not like Chase, Welles, or Blair. He told Lincoln that he could not serve in the cabinet with them. He said they would never be able to work together. Lincoln answered that he would be happy to make Seward ambassador to Britain instead of Secretary of State. Seward gave up the argument and agreed to join the cabinet.
Inauguration Day was the 4th of March. President-elect Lincoln rode to the ceremony with outgoing President James Buchanan. Buchanan was ready to give up his power. He told Lincoln, "If you are as happy to get into the White House as I am to get out of it, you must be the happiest man alive." The inaugural ceremony took place outside the Capitol building. Lincoln was to give his inaugural speech before being sworn in. He had worked hard on the speech. He wanted to say clearly what his policy would be on slavery and secession. These were the issues which divided the country. These were the issues which were leading the country to civil war. This is what Lincoln said.
There seems to be some fear among the people of the southern states that because a Republican administration is coming to power, their property and their peace and personal security are threatened. There has never been any reasonable cause for such fears. In fact, much evidence to the contrary has existed, open to their inspection. It is found in nearly all my published speeches. In one of those speeches, I declared that I had no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I said I believed I had no legal right to do so, and no wish to do so. This statement is still true. I can only say that the property, peace, and security of no part of the country are to be in any way endangered by the incoming administration.
Lincoln noted that 72 years had passed since the first president was inaugurated. Since then, he said, 15 men had led the nation through many dangers, generally with great success. He went on,
I now begin the same job under great difficulty. The breaking up of the Federal Union, before only threatened, now is attempted. I believe that under universal law and the Constitution, the union of these states is permanent. This is shown by the history of the Union itself. The Union is much older than the Constitution. It was formed, in fact, by the Articles of Association in 1774. It was continued by the Declaration of Independence in 1776. It grew further under the Articles of Confederation in 1778. And finally, in 1787, one of the declared reasons for establishing the Constitution of the United States was to form a more perfect union. I therefore believe that, in view of the Constitution and the laws, the Union is not broken. I shall make sure, as the Constitution orders me to do, that the laws of the Union are obeyed in all the states. In doing this, there needs to be no bloodshed or violence, and there shall be none unless it be forced upon the national government. The power given to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the taxes. But beyond what is necessary for these purposes, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere.
Lincoln then repeated some statements he had made during his campaign for president. He used them to explain the differences between North and South. One part of the country, he said, believes slavery is right and should be extended. The other part believes slavery is wrong and should not be extended. This, he said, was the only important dispute. Lincoln admitted that even if the dispute could be settled peacefully, there were those who wanted to see the Union destroyed. He said his words were not meant for them. They were meant only for those people who really loved the Union. He said,
"Physically speaking, we cannot separate. We cannot remove our sections from each other, nor build an impassable wall between them. A husband and wife may be divorced and go away from or out of the reach of each other. But the different parts of our country cannot do this. They must remain face to face. And relations, friendly or hostile, must continue between them. Is it possible to make those relations better after separation than before? Can aliens make treaties easier than friends can make laws? Can treaties be more faithfully enforced between aliens than laws can be enforced among friends? My countrymen, one and all, think calmly and well upon this subject. Nothing valuable can be lost by taking time. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the great issue of civil war. The government will not attack you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though emotion may have damaged them, it must not break our ties of love."
Abraham Lincoln then placed his hand on the Christian holy book, the Bible. The Chief Justice of the United States then spoke the presidential oath. Lincoln repeated the words, and the United States had a new president. Lincoln's first crisis came quickly. It was a problem left unsolved by the outgoing president. Lincoln had to decide immediately what to do about the federal fort in the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina, Fort Sumter. The fort was surrounded by Southern artillery. Southern gunboats guarded the harbor. The federal troops inside Fort Sumter were getting dangerously low on food. But any attempt to send more men or supplies would be seen as an act of war, civil war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.